very pleased to introduce Nigel Hickson for his second talk on geometric cohomology and ethics.
Okay, thank you very much. Hello, everyone. Doing okay? I know Dan is. Man, that's good. Okay, I talked about continuous fields of Hilbert spaces last time, and it was a bit of a rush at the end, so I'm going to begin by saying the same thing again. And then I thought what I'd dedicate the rest of the lecture to is a calculation aimed at showing you that these continuous fields are useful for something. We'll take a look at the index theorem and see if we can prove the index theorem today. All right, so but just to remind you, we were talking about continuous fields of Hilbert spaces. You might as well learn something. You're here for an hour and something, so you might as well. Let me give you the exact definition this time, just so no one can say that I didn't do it. Okay, so we have some topological space X. And so what is a continuous field? It consists of two things. First of all, just a family, a set of vector space of Hilbert spaces, one for each point in the space. And then some collection, in fact, a vector space of set theoretic sections, which is all you can ask for at the moment because we haven't glued these fibers together in any way. So that's what the data is, and then there are some axioms, but the axioms aren't very hard, and as I say, just for completeness, I'm actually going to write all of them down now. The first is that if S is one of these sections which has been prescribed from among all of the god-awful number of possible set theoretic sections, then the function which maps X to the norm of S of X, once you've taken the norm, you have this function now has the range, all the values of this function arrange themselves in the same place, namely the real numbers. This should be a continuous function. That's one axiom. The next axiom is just some sort of non-degeneracy thing. It just says that if I have a point in the space, I look at the set of all values that the sections take. This should be dense in the fiber. If it wasn't, you would just reduce the fiber, wouldn't you? And then it would be true. And the third axiom just says that there are enough continuous sections. There are no other continuous sections which you forgot to put into this collection here. It's a fact that uniform limits of continuous functions are continuous, and this axiom C tells you that the same thing is true for gamma. So it's a little bit complicated. It's epsilons and deltas, but what the heck. So suppose I have a point. Suppose I have a section, first of all. What should we call it? T. Just a set theoretic section to begin with. Suppose it has the following property, that wherever you look, and with whatever standard of accuracy you look with, suppose there's a neighborhood of X, and some section, which we're thinking of as a continuous section, which is close to T by a standard of epsilon in the neighborhood U. So the soup over all elements of U of the norm of T of Y minus S of Y less than epsilon. The conclusion is that T should belong to this family of sections which we are deeming to be the continuous sections. That's it. That says that a locally uniform limit of continuous sections ought to be also continuous, as is the case for functions. Functions have that property. Continuous functions have that property. All right. So
you could have something like this. Could you have sort of something like this?
Could I have something like this in which the fiber dimension, I think that's what you're drawing, changes. Yes, I'll come to that in just a moment.
For B, why is it that you only want them to be dense, not to be all of
For a reason that, because I'm about to say something else, which will make this locution clear. In fact, it's a theorem that if you have A, B, and C, then B can be replaced by the stronger statement that this vector space is all of H of X. So that's a theorem, the way I set things up, not part of the axioms. And so if you invent for yourself a family of HXs and a family of sections, and if you manage to do it in such a clever way that A and B are satisfied, there's always a canonical way of enlarging, in fact, a unique way of enlarging the section collection so that C is also true. There's a unique enlargement of gamma. It means that I have now a convenient way of creating continuous fields. I just have to build a collection of Hilbert spaces and a collection of sections which satisfy these two things, and then I can define the new gamma, the enlarged gamma, to be the set of all t's for which this is true, and then I'm done. So here's a sort of example that we're going to be interested in. Suppose we have a submersion of smooth manifolds, bunch of manifolds smoothly arranged over some base manifold or space of some sort. Well, we could do the following thing. We could take the family of vector spaces, which are the L2 spaces of the fibers. And in order to do that, we really ought to have some smooth family of Lebesgue measures on the fibers, or if you like, we ought to talk about half densities or something. That's a nuance which we needn't get into. And now we could define gamma to be, to begin with, the smooth functions of compact support. On the big manifold M, let's call this thing here star. That's a so if I have a function on M, of course I can restrict it to each fiber M sub X. And therefore, it will be a compactly supported smooth function on M sub X, and therefore I'll have an element of this Hilbert space, one for each X, and so that's a section, set theoretic section. Since we're talking about smooth functions, it's clear that we're not going to have C already, but we can apply this star to get C. Okay. The point I want to make is that it takes no effort at all to do this. You don't have to worry about local triviality of this submersion, which it won't be in the cases that we're interested in anyway. You just do it. It's very, very easy. No complicated conditions have to be satisfied. Okay. So this I continue with some remedial remarks, which I didn't have time to talk about last time, by just attempting to flesh out some of this. So here's a concrete geometric, if you like, example. But let me go back to the abstract theory. I think I mentioned this last time. The obvious way of building, apart from this maybe, the obvious, even more obvious way of building a continuous field is to define all of these H sub X's to be one and the same Hilbert space, for example, at little L2 of N. Okay, and then we'll define the continuous sections to be exactly the continuous functions in the usual sense from the base space X into the single canonical fiber L2 of N. That's a continuous field. Where is it? Here. Just check that right away. That's, again, a basic theorem about continuity. Okay. Just to, it sometimes is useful to make a new, to recognize the nuance between a field which is actually constant and one is, which is isomorphic to a constant field. So trivial fields are by definition isomorphic to constant fields. If I have a continuous field on a space X, and if Y is a subspace of X, there's a natural way of restricting the field from Y, from the big space X to Y. And for that matter, we can also pull back along maps. So these things have the same contravariant functoriality as vector bundles. Pull back a vector bundle along a continuous map. Pull back one of these things in really exactly the same way. Along a map. Okay. So we can talk about locally trivial fields. And not every continuous field of Hilbert spaces is locally trivial for exactly the reason that you pointed out. So not all continuous fields are locally trivial. There's an obvious abstraction, and then there's a more subtle abstraction, which I won't discuss. Here's one other thing you can do. Suppose we have Y sitting in X, which is open. And suppose X is compact, or locally compact would do. So it's not too big. Well, we can also push forward a field from Y to X. And here's how we do it. The fibers of the new field will agree with the fibers of the old field over those points of X which happen to lie in Y. And if you happen to be in a point of X which is not in Y, the fiber over it will just be zero. What about the sections, the continuous sections? Well, these will just be the continuous sections on the original field. Well, there's only one way to extend from the original field to the whole space, set theoretically, because we have zero fibers outside of Y. And to make the whole thing continuous, of course, we have to just insist on this requirement. It's the only way of making an extension which is consistent with number A here. But that's a continuous field. So the fiber dimension of a bundle need not be constant. And in particular, the thing need not be locally trivial. Okay. So these are funny things to play with. What makes them convenient is they're just so easy to construct. That's really the main message here. You might worry that they're so easy to construct that they have no reasonable structure or mathematical properties at all. That turns out not to be the case, and that's made evident by the following really beautiful result, which is tells you something about infinite dimensions, tells you something unexpected about infinite dimensions. First of all, before I get to that, if I have a vector bundle, I can think of it as a continuous field of Hilbert spaces which in which the fiber dimensions are all finite and locally constant. Well, I can if the fibers of the vector bundle have inner products. So Hermitian vector bundles are continuous fields. And as you know, Hermitian vector bundles, well, let's say we're talking about compact spaces X. A Hermitian vector bundle is a summand, an orthogonal summand of a trivial bundle. It's a basic result. It's theorem zero in K-theory that this is so. And there's a beautiful counterpart of this in infinite dimensions. It was proved by Dixmier and Duhaddy when they started thinking about these things in connection with C-star algebra issues. But then it was reproved and generalized substantially by Kasparov, and so it's usually called the Kasparov stabilization theorem. And what it says is that this is really remarkable. It's an easy result. It's even easier than the result above. But it's really remarkable when you bear in mind this type of construction over here. Anyway, it says that every continuous field is an orthogonal summand of a trivial. Obviously, with infinite dimensional fibers in general, every summand, as you know from vector bundle theory, every summand of a trivial bundle with finite rank fibers has to be a vector bundle, has to be locally trivial. In infinite dimensions, that's not true. The fiber dimension does not even have to be locally constant for it to be a summand of a trivial bundle. Amazing, but true. Okay. So you really have no alternative. I mean, there are a couple of ways of thinking about this. On the one hand, you could say, well, there's no alternative but to consider this relaxed definition, because surely if you want to consider any fields at all, you want to consider trivial fields, and surely a direct summand of a trivial field is no worse than the trivial field itself from most points of view, sort of projective. Okay. I mean, just a remark.
The definition of direct summand is point by point.
Yeah. So the fiber of the direct summand over a point x is just hx, direct sum, whatever, h prime x. And the sections are just the direct sums of continuous sections. There's one sensible way of defining the direct sum of a finite number of continuous fields of Hilbert spaces, and that's the right one. You can also take a direct sum of an infinite number, and then, of course, you have to worry a little bit more.
You gave us an example last time where we have just an interval, where just mm-hmm. a constant field clamped down at a point.
Yep, like this thing over on the right. Yeah.
So is there an easy way to see how to stabilize that thing?
Is there an easy way to stabilize one of these? The answer is yeah, but let me tell you something else to give as an exercise. So I'll make an analogy between this and some other exercises that you can do, purely algebraic exercises that you can do. But let me just end this sentence here. Maybe we can arrange a better way of putting it. There's no hope of getting any interesting K-theory groups of continuous fields, because if you can put a continuous field as a direct sum of a trivial field of infinite rank, you can certainly arrange that H plus trivial equals trivial by what people in our trade call an Eilenberg swindle. Okay. So at some sort of K-theoretic additive level, we have H plus something equals something, and therefore subtracting something, we get H equals zero. These things don't have an interesting K-theory. It's by adding in the Fredholm condition, by adding in a Fredholm operator on the field, that we get something which becomes sort of finitary and amenable to K-theoretic analysis. Okay, but let me just answer your question now. Suppose you have an open subset of a manifold. It is the case that the continuous functions, smooth functions, compactly supported on U. This is a summand of C infinity of M plus C infinity of M plus and so on. This you can easily calculate using a partition of unity. Having said that, the rest is an exercise. There's a small, there's fine print here. If the fields do not have some sort of countably infinite dimension, then you've got to worry about crazy issues. But we won't. Our fields will have countably infinite dimension, and we won't worry about that. Okay. Okay, so these are the things we're playing around with. We have a good notion of Fredholm operator on continuous fields and Kasparov's theorem. Is a version of the theorem of Vatier and Janik, is that if you have a decent space, it doesn't actually have to be compact, just locally compact will do the job. The K-theory of X, in the sense of Vatier and Hirzebruch, so the K-theory with compact supports of X, this is the K-theory for which the K-theory of the plane is the integers. That's not a good way of putting it. The K-theory of the plane is the integers of the other definition as well. This is K-theory with compact supports. This thing is exactly homotopy classes of Fredholm operators on continuous fields over X. So the definition of Fredholm operator also builds in this nice compact support condition. And as I tried to explain last time, this theorem is not only true, it's not only a counterpart of this, but it's easier and better than this theorem. It's easier to prove because you don't have to have recourse to anything like Kuiper's theorem on the contractibility of the group of invertibles on a Hilbert space. And it's better in the sense that you can very easily construct examples of Fredholm operators in this sense. So you can stick things into this group rather easily. This is supposed to be some receptacle for, in our context here, index theoretic information. So we want the receptacle to be as welcoming and inclusive and diverse as possible, and this one is. Okay, that's a little review. I think that's all I wanted to say in the way of review about these things. Any questions about continuous fields before we move on a little bit? No questions. Excellent. You all happy? Still happy? I mean, you were happy at the beginning. Still happy? So let me turn from abstract facts, such as would appeal to operator algebraists in the 1950s, like the stabilization theorem, and go back a little bit to operators, Dirac operators, manifolds, and so on, such as might appeal to you guys, you people. So I want to go back to operators of the general type of Dirac operators and see how they fit into this machinery that we were talking about before. The first thing I want to do in order to help combine PDE with Hilbert space theory is to introduce some gradings to replace operators which were formerly just operators with self-adjoint operators. That's relevant because people who study Hilbert space operators spend a lot of their time developing spectral theory, and the spectral theorem applies to self-adjoint operators, not arbitrary operators. So before, we were interested, or we discussed very briefly at the beginning of the last lecture, operators D of general Dirac type, such as, for example, the Cauchy-Riemann operator on the plane ddx plus I ddy. That's the sort of operator we're considering. Maybe we should add ddx plus I ddy plus some arbitrary function. That would be a perfectly fine operator for us. But in order to get something which more resembles a self-adjoint operator, let me throw in the formal adjoint of the operator to produce a little matrix of operators like this. And henceforth, I'm just going to call this whole thing D. So each D will be packaged now in a 2x2 matrix, which is clearly completely determined by the original D. And from time to time, it's important to have access to the original D from the new D, and you can easily get that by introducing this grading operator here. Once you have this grading operator, a little bit of algebra will isolate the old D from the new D and vice versa. Now, if the manifold on which this operator is defined happens to be a closed manifold, then this D, which we've made into a formally self-adjoint operator, is what operator algebraists, operator theorists call essentially self-adjoint. This is the sort of thing that, in certain contexts, people have to spend endless time worrying about. You have some potential of the Schrodinger equation, and you write down the Schrodinger equation, and now you want to figure out the states, the energy states, and it doesn't even make sense to ask that unless the operator has a decent spectral theory, and it won't have a decent spectral theory unless this funny condition or something very close to it is satisfied. There's a difference between formally self-adjoint, like this, and actually self-adjoint in the sense of operator theory, in the sense of von Neumann. However, for the sorts of operators we'll be dealing with, that issue never occurs. Okay? And anyway, what does this mean? Well, first of all, operator has an additional important property, which is that it has compact resolvent. So what this means is basically that the operator can be diagonalized. Basically means, in fact, if I'm not very specific, it exactly means this. It means you can find an orthonormal basis of the L2 space on which the operator is acting, which contains the smooth functions on which the operator is acting. We have an orthonormal basis, and the elements are eigenfunctions. And the eigenvalues, which are all real by self-adjointness, march off to infinity. Now, the way you prove this is that you figure out what essentially self-adjoint and compact resolvent mean, and you prove those two things, and then you apply a theorem of Hilbert, the famous Hilbert spectral theorem, to get these UNs. So the UNs are not primitives here. What are primitive are the two things, two statements that I underlined. So let me just remind you, because not every geometer or topologist thinks about these things. If you take the operator, which is formally self-adjoint, like this, and you add I to it, or minus I to it, what you get is an operator which is always one-to-one. In fact, the norm of this operator applied to a vector is always at least the norm of the vector. This operator is bounded below by one. That's a simple calculation. So this guy here is one-to-one. Okay? To say that it's essentially self-adjoint is to say that both of these guys have dense range. And what that means is you can form bounded operators of the type that I've just written down, resolvent operators, from the operator. Because this operator is one-to-one and has dense range, there is a densely defined inverse, but this operator, because this one was bounded below by one, has norm no more than one, and therefore extends by continuity to the whole Hilbert space. Okay? That's what essentially self-adjoint means. It means these two statements, that d plus I has dense range and d minus I has dense range. And it sounds like a funny thing to worry about, but it's actually, I mean, there's a bunch of very useful set of techniques for checking this in examples, and this is really one of the most elementary examples here, the case of a first-order operator on a closed manifold. Okay. In fact, I can go a little bit further than this. If I have any function, which is a continuous function on the real line, and for safety, let's just say bounded, we can build an operator H of D, which is a bounded operator. I'm just reminding you about the functional calculus here. And this works out in the best possible way. All the useful algebra that you might expect to hold does hold. And of course, if H is one of these resolvent functions, what you get are just the resolvents. So the spectral theorem is the observation that once you have the two resolvent operators, you can build any function of D at all, as long as H is, say, something reasonable. Let's say bounded and continuous. You can do a lot better than that if you need to. Okay. I talked a bit about, I'm not going to go into this much today, but I talked a bit about another theorem of it here, an observation, really, concerning elliptic operators in Hilbert space. It was a sort of compact commutation. It was a compact commutation property like this. I'm just reminding you of this. So what is this F? Well, F was old style, an old style operator, not within this context of Z2 grading. So let's put it in the Z2 grading context. What this thing is just exactly H of D, well, plus maybe a compact perturbation, which is irrelevant. And for H, you can choose any function which looks like this. It should be an odd function. It should go to plus 1, plus infinity, and minus 1, minus infinity. And you can easily check that this operator of which I was speaking is given by the functional calculus. That gives good access to this operator and allows you, for example, to prove Atiyah's claim rather easily within the context of Hilbert space operators. Okay, that's just, for the moment, a parenthetical remark. We'll come back to that in the next lecture. But maybe I should say this, that if we have a Dirac-type operator, such as we've been talking about, and we want to create an honest, bounded Hilbert space operator out of it, what we'll clearly do on the basis of this observation is we'll apply H to it for H such a function as this. This is like the arctangent function, isn't it, or something similar. Okay. That'll produce a bounded operator. And if we want to have access to the original Fredholm index, we should take the lower left-hand corner of this bounded operator. That will be a Fredholm operator as long as these conditions here, which I've written down, are satisfied, which they are in a closed manifold situation. All right. So this is how you go from a single operator of Dirac type, or much more general type, to a Hilbert space operator, to a bounded Hilbert space Fredholm operator. Now, what happens if I have more than one operator? Suppose I have a family of operators. So suppose we have a submersion. Just locally a projection from RP plus Q down to RQ, let's say, p-dimensional fibers. Well, same story. And once you get the hang of it, I mean, it's rather difficult to talk about diagonalizing families of operators, because then you have to worry about keeping track of eigenvalues and how do the eigenvalues change as you move from one fiber to another. It's rather difficult to keep track of that, but it's not difficult at all to keep track of these things. And if the overall space here, M, is compact, by the way, I'm going to allow X to have a boundary, but the fibers of this map shouldn't have any boundary at all. So the fibers should be like this. Here's the base, and the fibers should be like this, and you should be projecting down. There's a name for that. But anyway, that's what we're considering here. The fibers, the Dirac operators, will always be defined on manifolds without boundary. And if M is compact, as I say, same story. So in particular, a family of Dirac-type operators on compact manifolds gives rise to a Fredholm operator on a continuous field, and therefore has an index in the K-theory of the base. That's the family's index construction from the Atiyah-Singer theory. But we're not interested, I mean, we are interested in that, but we're interested in going a little bit further and considering more elaborate situations. And so let me dwell a little bit on what happens when M is not compact. Well, if M is not compact, problems can arise, and they'll even arise in the situation of one single operator. But the problems are rather mild and can be managed with tools, as I'll show you. The first thing to worry about is whether or not the operator is self-adjoint, so we can launch ourselves into the world of spectral theory and Hilbert spaces and operators and everything that Hilbert liked. That is a fairly mild problem. The operator D will always be essentially self-adjoint. If, well, as I say, there's an immense theory here dealing with all sorts of complicated operators. I'll answer your question when I... Was that a question or just stretching? I'll be there in a moment. If, for example, the manifold is complete. So suppose the manifold is, in fact, Riemannian, and assume that the Dirac operator is designed in accordance with the metric. So, for example, ddx plus iddy on the plane satisfies those requirements. Essential self-adjointness is not a major issue for the sorts of situations we shall be considering, and in all of those situations, we shall be able to build, fiber-wise, these operators, this functional calculus. Now I'll answer your question. I'll hear your question first, and then I'll decide whether to answer it. the same story here means that if M is compact submersion, then the Dirac operators on each of the individual fibers are essentially self-adjoint and have compact resolvent. And moreover, if you consider those compact resolvents as a family of operators, as one operator on the continuous field, that family is itself a compact operator in the sense of compact operators on continuous fields. To be a compact operator on a continuous field is to say more than the individual operators in each fiber are compact. There's more to it than that, but that more to it is taken care of by whatever it is that you have to do to check that the same story, that the story is indeed the same. That's what I mean. When you pass to families, you get a family of operators which is compact in the sense of families, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? Okay. And what about compactness? Well, if F is a C0 function, compact disported or C0 function on M, we can regard F as a multiplication operator on L2 of M. We can also regard F as a multiplication operator on the family of L2 of M sub X's that we were considering before. And it is the case that F times H of D is compact for a C0 function. Sorry for drifting off here. H on the line. Of course, if M was compact, we could let F be the constant function 1, and then we'd be back in this situation here. So this, what's written here, is a mild elaboration of what's here. In a way, I mean, if this is how you want to think about the non-compact case, then this story here is exactly the same as this story here. These theorems are proved in exactly the same way as these ones here. There's nothing to it. However, this is not enough to conclude that D is a Fredholm operator and has a Fredholm index. So, for example, considering our favorite example here on the plane, this is essentially self-adjoint, but it does not have compact resolvent. So there really is a problem. It's not just that we were not clever enough to prove the theorem. This thing is not compact for the sorts of H's which I'm talking about over there. To make this thing, so D is not Fredholm, there's no index floating around here. To make this thing into something which does have an index, you have to add some sort of potential term to the D-bar operator, change the operator. But you hope that in various situations that will lead to some interesting mathematics. We'll take a look at one in a moment. You could consider this. How to say this? You could look at the function R, which measures the distance from the origin. If you square it, that's a nice smooth function. And then you could look at the form, d bar of R squared. And you could look at multiplication by that form. That's what d bar of r squared means. And now this operator, this is like a potential term. It's a function added to the differential operator, an order zero term added to the operator. This, if you add an order zero term, nothing goes wrong with the central self-adjointness. But this thing now does become Fredholm. It does have compact resolvent. This potential term is like this. It gets bigger as you march off to infinity. And that makes the 1 over the operator smaller as you march off to infinity. It makes it small enough that the overall operator is compact. This overall operator is compact. Okay. Here's a little picture. It's a fun little thing, which related to things we'll talk about on Tuesday, I guess. Let's consider this picture here. Let me see if I'm up to drawing it. Here's a copy of C. I'm taking a section through C in order to not over-challenge my artistic abilities. And let me rest a sphere on it. In fact, let me rest a whole bunch of spheres, like Horace spheres, on it like this. Starting with some one sphere of fixed size here, and then going outwards. So if you think about it, this space fibers over an interval, right? This gauges the spheres, tells me which sphere I'm on, and that gives me a projection down to here, which is a submersion. Here's a fun exercise. So, associated to this picture, there is a continuous field of Hilbert spaces, and on that continuous field of Hilbert spaces, there is a Fredholm operator, or if you like, a family of Fredholm operators on the fibers, which interpolates. Let's call this 0 here, and this 1. Between the usual Debye operator on M0, which is the sphere, so these funny constructions can be sort of put together in interesting ways. So what happens from this construction is that the indices, Fredholm indices of the original D-bar and this thing, are equal according to Kasparov's basic theorem. Okay. This is a sort of very elementary example of the sort of thing I want to talk about on Tuesday. I want to also talk about funny deformations like this one today, but they're a little more, they're a little less sophisticated than this. This is actually a rather non-trivial example, and we're going to be looking at something rather more elementary. Let me tell you what it's connected to. So this is an exercise. If you're keen, you have the whole weekend to think about this before Tuesday. Of course, you know. I mean, you can just calculate the two indices at the ends, and then you could apply a Kasparov's theorem to say there has to be a family in between. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about geometrically building an interpolating family. Here's another example. Which is more in the spirit of where I want to go for the remainder of the lecture. Suppose I have a vector space with an inner product. It, of course, has a Clifford algebra. And this Clifford algebra has a basic spin representation. Let's just say the thing is even dimensional just to make matters as simple as possible. Later on, so we're going to try and tackle the index theorem, and to keep my formulas somewhat resembling correct, I mean, there are signs which come up, but all the signs disappear if the manifold is 4K dimensional. Okay, so here's a famous operator, the operator of Dirac, right here in Singer. So this is acting, say, on the functions on V, which are S-valued. This is the famous Dirac operator. So the EJs represent an orthonormal basis of this vector space, and the XJs are the dual coordinates on the vector space. This, of course, is the Dirac. becomes ready-made in this Z2 graded form, as you probably know. It's not Fredholm. I mean, we have this same problem with this as we have with the D-bar operator. The D-bar operator, of course, is an example of this situation here. But now you could do something else. We could let this same D, same formula, act on not S-valued functions, but S-tensor S-valued functions, which is the same thing as and S-valued functions, and by Clifford algebra theory, that's the same thing as Clifford algebra of S of V. Now here's a function on V, which is Clifford algebra valued. We'll define the value at V just to be the vector V times the grading operator. So what is this? This is a function from V to the Clifford algebra of V. And it acts on this space of test functions by right multiplication. I mean, it acts by left or right multiplication, but I want to think of it as acting by right multiplication. Oh, got to be a little bit.
Epsilon of V?
No, epsilon is the gamma 5, whatever, the grading operator in this algebra.
Volume.
Yeah, volume element. There's a little nuance here. I don't know if I should fess up to it. What I really want, if we're really keeping score, is I want epsilon to act by multiplication on the left and V to act by Clifford algebra multiplication on the right. Just a little piece of bookkeeping there, more signs. Okay. Well, now you can do the following thing. You can just add C to D. We've added a potential term, a function, to our differential operator. Okay, and now we've done here exactly what we did in the previous example. This thing is, again, Fredholm. As many people know, it has index 1. This is a beautiful operator because when you square it, once you get all the signs right, which I have deliberately not attempted to do, what you get is the Laplace operator. When you square the Clifford algebra, you get the norm squared. That's R squared, as we were talking about before. And then we have the vector space of some dimension here. What do we call it? 2k. Get this the right way around. So n is this so-called number operator. Clifford algebra is integer graded, not as an algebra, but as a vector space, and so there's a grading operator on a number operator on it. The basic, the spectral theory of the harmonic oscillator, which every quantum mechanic knows, allows you to deduce now that this operator has index 1. And that's a calculation that we'll be using in just a moment. So here are a couple of examples. Here's one more example. Before I go on, let me make a point about the index of this operator. The index of this operator, the kernel of this operator, is just the function e to the minus r squared times 1, the unit of the Clifford algebra. The kernel of this operator is not just an element of this vector space. It's an element which is invariant under all possible rotations of this vector space. So the equivariant index of this operator is 1. That's a small point which we'll take advantage of in just a moment. Anyway, here's one more example. Again, in the same vein of Clifford algebras and so on. Suppose I have a manifold M, dimension 2k. And if you really want to believe that my signs are close to reality, it's convenient to imagine that K is even. I mean, everything works in the non-even case, you just have to be more careful. Okay, now suppose that this is spin C. It means that the bundle of Clifford algebras of the tangent space has attached to it a module, which is a vector bundle over M, something that one studies in K-theory. So we have S, a certain spinner bundle. It may have more than one spinner bundle, but to equip the manifold with a spin C structure is to mean that you've equipped it with a certain choice of spinner bundle, which is fiber-wise a module for the Clifford algebra with this property here. Okay. Here's something you can do, which is kind of interesting. Actually, maybe I'll do it in a slight. Extra degree of generality. So suppose V is a spin C vector bundle. The spinner bundle S. It means that fiber-wise, the Clifford algebra of V acts on S, and it does so irreducibly in such a way that the endomorphisms of each fiber of S are exactly the endomorphisms, are exactly the Clifford algebra of V. Okay. So attached to this is a Proudhon operator. It's all finite dimensional and geometric, and there are no derivatives, no Dirac operators here, but you can do the following thing. On the space, on the topological space, which is the total space of V, you can build a continuous field whose fiber, maybe we'll call it H, whose fiber over a given point is just the spinner bundle over pi of V. So pi is just the vector bundle projection. That's what the continuous field is, and now you can build a Fredholm operator to go with it. So for each fiber of this continuous field, I want to build a Fredholm operator on that fiber. That's not very hard. It's a finite dimensional vector space. Every operator is Fredholm, so I can write down fiber-wise whatever I like. Of course, I have to worry about continuity, and I also have to worry about some sort of condition at infinity. But here's what we'll do. It's very easy. What should we call it? Let's call it D, even though it has nothing to do with differentiation. DV will just be Clifford multiplication by V. So V, a point in this parameter space, is a vector in this vector bundle, so it acts by Clifford multiplication on this Clifford representation. It's an operator, and it's Fredholm because it's finite dimensional. Okay. And then there's some issue here. What I've written down is a skew adjoint operator, but if I multiply by the grading operator, it becomes self-adjoint. This is Fredholm. Maybe a better way of saying this is that this has H of this family compact. So it has an index. I mean, there's no differentiation, and fiber-wise, these operators are just operators on finite dimensional vector spaces, no index there at all. But globally, there's an index, and where does it lie? It lies in the K theory of the total space of V. This is the Tom class of V. So we'll call this T. Of course, it depends on the choice of spin C structure, S. Okay. Let me go over there, I guess. This, again, takes advantage of some growth properties. As you move away from a, maybe I should have said, assuming here that M is compact, as you move away from a compact set in V, the vectors little v get bigger and bigger and bigger, and so these Clifford operators, C of V, or just V acting as Clifford multiplication, these operators have spectrum which gets bigger and bigger and bigger. The spectrum of Clifford multiplication by V is plus or minus the square root of the norm of V. Yeah. No, plus or minus the norm of V, no square root. So those are three examples, and now we're sort of homing in on the index theorem. Why? Well, this thing here is how you define the topological index. So go back to where we were with a spin C manifold. Suppose we think of M as embedded in a Euclidean space. Let's build the normal bundle of this embedding. This has a canonical spin, it's a vector bundle on M, and it has a canonical spin C structure because there's a basic 2 out of 3 principle for spin C structures, just as there are for orientations. You have a short exact sequence of vector spaces, and two of them have carry spin C structures, vector bundles, excuse me, and two of them carry spin C structures, and so does the third. It's not just spin C ab all. God has given this thing a spin C structure. God will give it a spin C structure whenever you give M a spin C structure. Thanks, God. All right, so there's a class, which is the Tom class of F. Actually, for every spin C structure, there's a so-called opposite spin C structure, whose S is basically the complex conjugate vector bundle. So that's the one we want to deal with. This is something the K-theory of the normal bundle, total space of the normal bundle. It's a K-theory class. And this normal bundle by the tubular neighborhood theorem sits as an open subset of V. And therefore, this K-theory class pushes forward by the push-forward construction, for example, we talked about at the beginning, to give a K-theory class on the vector space V, which I didn't say so, but I'm thinking of this as an even-dimensional vector space. So by Bott periodicity, it's just the integers. So I obtain from this thing an integer. That is supposed to be the index of the Dirac operator on M. That's what the index formula says, up to signs, which I think will disappear if the dimension is congruent to 0 mod 4. Okay. So let's see if we can connect this fellow here to the index of the Dirac operator, and then we'll be done. I will rush through this now and maybe say a few more words next time. So this is, it's a K-theory class. It's not a number, but it gives rise to a number by, for example, taking the Chern character and integrating or pushing forward to K-theory of V and applying the Bott periodicity theorem, or taking the Chern character there, whatever you like. This is the topological index. Of the manifold M. The spin C manifold M. And it's supposed to be equal to the analytic index, the Fredholm index of the Dirac operator on M. Okay, so let's see if we can do that. I want to go back to this picture we had a little while ago. And build a picture connected to the embedding of M in V, which is related to it, which is certainly familiar in algebraic geometry and other places. This is called the deformation space, or the deformation to the normal cone, if you're an algebraic geometer. It's a certain set, which I'm going to make into a smooth manifold. And what it is the disjoint union of the ordinary normal bundle with a whole bunch of copies of the big space V. It's a certain set which I'll make into a manifold. And this manifold fibers over the unit interval. And the fibers are either this normal bundle or copies of V. They all have the same dimensions, so it kind of makes sense. Okay? And this is the picture corresponding to the embedding of a point in a sphere, more or less, depending on how exactly you view this picture. So it has, in a natural way, the structure of a smooth manifold. And let me just briefly tell you how to make it so. First of all, there's an obvious map down to V times 0, 1. After all, if I have a normal vector, in particular, it's a vector. And so it has a base, which is a point of M. And M is a point of V, so I can project the normal bundle down first to M and then include M into V. That's what's happening at T is equal to X equal to 0 in this parameter. Everywhere else, the fibers are just copies of V, so the map is the obvious thing. And this should be a smooth map, and in fact, a diffeomorphism away from 0. And there's a whole bunch of others, so I've constructed one smooth function on this deformation space. Here's a bunch of others. If I have a function on V, which is smooth, and if its restriction to M is 0, now let me build out of that a function on this deformation space in the following way. Let's call it, F twiddle or something. So what will I do? F twiddle of a pair V comma T will be 1 over T times V. F twiddle of a normal vector at 0 will just be that normal vector applied to M. Then this thing here is smooth. So there's a canonical natural C-infinity structure, which is actually generated by these functions. These functions are adequate to supply coordinates on this space. I'm going to think of this as a parameter space. It's a certain manifold, fibers over 0, 1, but I want to think of the whole big gelatinous thing as a parameter space for a family of Fredholm operators. Okay, and what's that going to be? Well, there's a fairly natural submersion from this simple product space here down to V, which is defined as follows. So we'll send an M, a V, and a T. I wrote down the formula because otherwise, well, I wrote it down, but you know, then I lost it. Okay. Here's what it does if T is not 0. What happens at T equal 0, well, I want to think of V, which is a vector in V, as a so I want to think of the vector space V as decomposing, as tangent directions to the manifold orthogonal some normal direction, so I can just project here like that. Let me draw a picture of what's going on here, which might make you feel happier. Here's V, and here's M. And M sits inside V. And that means, apart from the ordinary projection from M down into V, it makes sense to take these skew projections here. Which is a projection of slope T. And the inverse image of each point in V in this projection, it is a copy of the manifold M, but it's a sort of stretched out copy of the manifold N. It gets more and more stretched out as T gets smaller and smaller. In the limit, as T goes to 0, you're basically just getting stretched out copies of, well, not all of V, but the tangent directions in V to M at that point. Okay. So this is a a natural way of projecting from M to V, which is it's like a rotation in Atiyah's rotation argument for proof of Bach periodicity. There's a sort of degeneracy when T is equal to zero, but that's taken care of by this funny construction here. This funny construction allows you to continue this projection all the way to and including T is equal to zero. And I want to do the following thing, which is really easy to write down. What I want to do is to consider the Dirac operator on the fibers, if you like, the fiberwise Dirac operator on the fibers of this submersion, tensor 1 or graded tensor product 1 plus 1 tensor Clifford multiplication by this function C that we were discussing before. So where is this thing acting? This is it's acting on sections of the spinner bundle of M. Each fiber looks like a copy of M, so it has the same spinner bundle on it that M did. But now I'm just tensoring this S here, which we call it S of V. By this, maybe I'll call it S sub V. This is just the spinner vector space for V, for the vector space V. V is a vector space. It has a Clifford algebra. It has a unique irreducible representation. That's what I'm talking about here. Okay?
You know, did this, when this argument came, did it start with, this is very much like, and almost identical to the proof of the Grothendieck-Riemann-Roch theorem. Yeah, I wonder which one came first.
The answer is Grothendieck came first. There's no doubt about that. This is a sort of back formation from a more elaborate argument of Alain Cohn using groupoids. So in other words, it's 20 or 30 years after Grothendieck.
Because he used literally that space.
And Baum and Fulton and McPherson, I think, are the connect Grothendieck to this sort of operator theory. Okay, well, you can see what's about to happen here. So, we started off with a family of Dirac operators. And that family of Dirac operators is a family of elliptic operators on the fibers, but it does not give a globally Fredholm family. Why doesn't it give a globally Fredholm family? Because of the non-compactness of the situation, the non-compactness of the base, and the non-compactness also of the fibers at t is equal to zero. So we have to add a potential term, as we did in our baby examples. That's what this thing here is. And now we have a family of honest Fredholm operators, and we obtain an index of this family. And where it lies is in the K-theory of this funny space. Now, the honest normal bundle sits inside this funny space at T is equal to zero. And V sits inside this space at T is equal to 1, or T equal to 1/2, if you like. At T is equal to 0, the fibers of our basic map, which has now disappeared, stick it over here again, the fibers at T is equal to 0 are vector spaces. They are copies of the tangent spaces of M. At T is equal to 0, the operators which are involved are very simple operators. They're constant coefficient operators on a vector space plus a linear potential term. They are exactly the square roots of the harmonic oscillators that we were considering just a while ago, and their index is easy to calculate. And what you find, which I have to write over here, is that at T is equal to 0, the index is exactly what we were talking about. Namely, how did I write that? The term of this now. what happens at t is equal to 1? Well, at t is equal to 1, we have the standard projection. Maybe the slope is not t is equal to 1. We have the not the standard projection, but the 45-degree projection. But that's clearly homotopic to the standard projection, so let me continue the homotopy so we can talk about the standard projection. We have the standard projection, and what we have here is just an external product. This Clifford multiplication is Clifford multiplication by a constant number, which doesn't depend on the manifold parameter M. It only depends on V. So this is a product of what's called the Bott element, or the Tom class for a point, with the Dirac. But remember, in Kasparov's theory, every Dirac, or every Fredholm operator is homotopic to its index. This thing here is, can just be replaced by the index of the Dirac. Here's the Bott element. So what you get here is, if you like, the Tom class of S, otherwise known as the Bott class. By continuity, the Chern characters of these two fellows are equal, where they lie in different spaces. But if you integrate over those spaces, you'll get two numbers, and those two numbers are equal. So the index of the Dirac operator times the Chern character of the Bott element is equal to the Chern character of this thing here. And if you're in dimension congruent to 0 mod 4, the Chern character of the Bott element integrated over V is 1. So what you get is the index of D is equal to the integral of the Chern character of this thing. Otherwise, there are some minus signs. All right, thanks very much.